this week was a tough week for this country. The mob of pro-Trump supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol, as you know, disrupting the certification of the electoral vote. We've had now, I believe, 82 people have been arrested. Many people have been injured, including police officers, and five dead that are attributable to this mob scene. Curious here, what caused this? What confluence of societal issues gave rise to what happened here? And we've been seeing the rhetoric, we've been seeing the back and forth, but now it's culminated in violence. And with me to discuss this issue is Dr. Larry Diamond. He's a PhD senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Freeman Spoily Institute for International Studies at Stanford. He's written many books and contributed to many more on the issue of democracy and American foreign policy. Dr. Diamond, thank you for joining me.
Yeah, good afternoon, Karen.
Do you think these events were predictable in your field, in the area where you're studying the sociology of democracy and people speaking out? And was this something that you and your colleagues perhaps predicted?
I don't want to talk about predicted in the literal sense, but I'd say many of us did foresee and did worry about the very serious prospect of violence post-election. We wrote about it. We had public opinion survey evidence that warned about it. We certainly saw the chatter in extremist networks and social media online. I don't think anybody foresaw, and certainly the Capitol Police and leadership right. did not foresee, an effort to seize the building and possibly, I think, potentially murder large numbers of Congress members and congressional leaders. It's, I think, inexcusable that the building was not secured. It's tragic that people did not take these warnings more seriously, but it's horrifying that we came so close to a much worse mass tragedy.
If you could bullet point some of the causes here that led to this, what would they be?
Well, I'd say you mentioned the sociological lens. Sociologically, we have a large and growing slice of American society that is very, very deeply disaffected, I'd say both on the right and the left. And is enmeshed in, you know, really isolated, siloed chambers of disinformation and radicalization and egging one another on in almost the digital version of, you know, cult isolation. Where you get cut off from moderating and competing points of view. And I think, you know, if you were to do a kind of social analysis of who these people were, you'd find a lot of people who are, you know, not well employed, marginally employed, not well educated, might have been in the military. We know some of them were, and left. But, you know, they have been feeding off their anger and all of the rumors and conspiracy theories that abound on a poorly moderated social media space. Secondly, we had the big lie that has been propagated ever since the election in November, that the election was a fraud, that it was stolen. That somehow there were millions of votes that Trump won that weren't counted, or millions of voters for Biden that were fictitious, and that Trump, I think Trump would claim he really won the popular vote, which is, of course, absolutely delusional, as it is also wrong to argue, and more than 60 courts have validated, that there's no evidence to the claim that he even won those few states that he narrowly lost in the popular vote. And so that brings us to the final element of Trump and Senator Josh Hawley and Senator Ted Cruz and some other Republican political leaders, but most of all, Donald J. Trump, egging this on and feeding this. And the protesters made very clear they were going there for Trump. They were going there on his appeal and instructions. He incited this. I think he's guilty of criminal incitement. I think he should be prosecuted for it after he leaves office. And I think we have to hold a large number of people accountable.
Dr. Diamond, I have always in my lifetime thought that Americans are very skeptical people, and they need proof. And if they don't see proof, and if it's not something they can have tangible evidence of, that they disbelieve it. And why is it that, let's just take this issue of voter fraud, even if you're a Donald Trump fan, even if you are sad that he wasn't elected, we know that there was no voter fraud. And as you said, 60 courts, and these are courts that were some of them very conservative, and some of the judges were appointed by Donald Trump himself. And even Attorney General Barr said there was no voter fraud, and he is a big supporter of Donald Trump. So that said, how do people believe something that's not true? And why is it that they believe it so clearly that they actually got on planes and trains and went and committed felonies?
Well, you get people who come to be encapsulated in networks or social milieus of conviction, of deep, almost religious belief that they identify with very profoundly. And I think part of the, you don't really understand this if you don't understand the importance of identity. And these people identify with Donald Trump. They identify with his cause. Many of them identify with the white supremacist groups that feed into this, and the QAnon conspiracy networks that feed into this. And once you start with quasi-religious beliefs that are tied up with someone's existential identity and existential grievance, after that, Karen, it's always backward reasoning. You start with what you believe, and then you very selectively assemble facts and arguments and statements to justify what you think. Jonathan Haidt, the great social psychologist at NYU, has written trenchantly about this. And then social media, as I said, has encapsulated these people in viral networks where their ranks can grow and they can get these images of fear and outrage, some of them fed by memes and by photos and even fake photos that seem to give even more compelling evidence, even though it's false evidence, to their beliefs. Keep in mind, we really need to have a historical perspective here, that there have been previous eras of passionate extreme right or extreme left or just deranged political associations and beliefs. Why did so many people believe Joe McCarthy when he said, I have a list of, you know, X hundred number of communists in the State Department, and he could, you know, he could never manage to release it? Or why did so many rise to the call of the John Birch Society, claiming that, you know, Eisenhower was part of a communist plot to take over the United States? I mean, we've always had what my late colleague and mentor Seymour Martin Lipset called in a famous book, the politics of unreason, the politics of irrational cult-like extremism. But now it's supercharged by social media.
Do you think COVID has added to this violence? And I'm not a sociologist, but it just seems to me that this isolation and this whole idea of people, some people are mask wearers. Some people believe that you have a right not to wear a mask and you don't have to do certain things. And the close down of businesses and churches was against all individual rights, and their individual rights are more important in some ways than the collective health and safety of our country. At least is that that's the way I look at it. What did that? Do you think that that contributed to what happened this week?
I don't know. As a social scientist, of course, I'd like to see evidence and analysis, which I'm sure will be done in the months and years to come, because we are living through. I don't want to say we've been through, because this is very far from over. But we are living through one of the most dangerous challenges to our constitutional form of government from within the United States, and I think our 244-year political history. But that said, I think there's a strong presumptive case for the validity of what you're saying. It's not just that they have been in rebellion against mask wearing and against government efforts to contain the virus, and in some cases, denial of the reality of the virus at all. I think that the economic crisis, which has, you know, expanded unemployment, diminished job opportunities, and the social crisis of physical isolation has very likely been an aggregating factor.
Dr. Larry Diamond,
was brewing before the COVID pandemic hit.
Right. I'm so sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off. We have news. I want to thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Larry Diamond of Stanford. Take care, and we'll check in again soon. Stay well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And now the news.